Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Arts and Sciences Center for the Humanities titled Comics as Documentary, Words, Images, and War. Our speaker is Hilary Choute, professor of English at the University of Chicago. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Anna Henchman, assistant professor of English at Boston University.
It's a great privilege to welcome Hilary Choute as a speaker in the Lectures and Criticism series at Boston University this evening. In the 8 years since she defended her dissertation at Rutgers University, Hilary Choute has emerged as the leading voice in the growing academic field of comics as literature. She is a thinker of extraordinary precision and energy. Although she is really just at the beginning of her career, the impact that her work has already had is evident in the 3 books that she has thus far written and collaborated on in the past 4 years, her many articles, the dozens of talks she's been invited to give all over the world, and the courses in which her scholarly work is being taught, including at least a few I know of here at Boston University. Even more unusual is the enthusiasm with which Choute's work has been received by the most important authors writing graphic narratives today, several of whom have enlisted Choute in the project of articulating what it is about the form of the graphic narratives that makes them such a compelling genre. I'm thinking here of the book she edited with Art Spiegelman, Metamouse, the course she taught with Alison Bechdel at the University of Chicago, her many author interviews, and an extraordinary conference she organized on comics, philosophy, and practice that brought together Phoebe Gluckner, Joe Sacco, Chris Ware, Aileen Kaminsky-Crum, Robert Crumb, Spiegelman, Bechdel, and a mind-boggling collection of other comics authors. Her essays have appeared in American Periodicals, Modern Fiction Studies, PMLA, 20th Century Literature, and Women's Studies Quarterly, among others, and she's written for publications including The Village Voice, The Believer, and Poetry. Her talk tonight is entitled Comics as Documentary, Words, Images, and War.
It's such a pleasure to be here. And Anna, thank you so much for that lovely introduction. I feel like you made all of my good points already in your introduction, so this will just be a repetition, I guess. It's such an honor to be part of the Lectures and Criticism series, so thank you very much for inviting me, and thank you very much for having me. I always like to start my talks with one of my favorite slides, which was now 10 years ago from The New Yorker. So you know if The New Yorker is making fun of the form you study, that form has really arrived. So just a little prefatory comment. As Anna maybe made clear, this talk tonight on war comics and documentary comes out of research for my book, which is called Disaster is My Muse, Visual Witnessing, Comics, and Documentary Form, which focuses on how visual verbal forms of witness have developed in response to the urgencies of war. So it's not an accident post 9/11 and the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq that there is an increase in attention to documentary experimentation, just as there also was during the period of the Vietnam War. So actually, the author of a recent study of 9/11 literature wondered if the enterprise of fiction could withstand the public appetite for documentary after the 9/11 attacks. Now, this appetite for documentary isn't bounded only to American subjects. So current and controversial film documentaries that are out right now, such as The Act of Killing, about the death squads in Indonesia in the 1950s and 60s, and The Missing Picture, about the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia in the 1970s, are all about the ability or the inability to picture historical violence. We are now in a kind of golden age of documentary in which attention to myriad forms of recording and archiving is greater than ever, and the work of documentary is central to all kinds of different conversations. But despite the fact that the hand-drawn form of comics has emerged afresh as a major location for documentary investigation, particularly about war, there has not been sustained critical attention to documentary comics. However, there are fascinating conversations happening around the aesthetics and politics of documentary and drawing, which we saw just in the news when the United Nations released their report on human rights in North Korea that contained drawings documenting the experiences of an escaped political prisoner. And this is just a screenshot from Time magazine. And his name is Kim Kwon-il. And here's another one of the 8 sketches that were released. So one of the most widely cited texts in current debates about images and war is Susan Sontag's Regarding the Pain of Others, which is a history of images of atrocity and also the last book that she wrote. So Sontag laments what she wants us to recognize today as the camera-mediated knowledge of war, which weakens the apprehension of war's force for her. And she reserves one of her iciest comments for famous criticals of spectacle like Guy Debord. She writes, and I'm quoting her here, "To speak of reality becoming a spectacle is a breathtaking provincialism. It has become a cliche of the cosmopolitan discussion of images of atrocity to assume they have little effect and that there is something innately cynical about their diffusion. It is notable in Regarding the Pain of Others that Sontag barely has a single compliment to dispense until she gets to Francisco Goya, roughly 50 pages in. So it's a book essentially about photography whose most celebrated figure is Goya. One of Goya's etchings from his famous Disasters of War series, which bears witness through images and captions to atrocities perpetrated by French soldiers during the Spanish War of Independence, even graces the cover of her book. The handmade aspect of Goya's etchings, in Sontag's view, constitutes their power and is responsible for how they elicit responsiveness, assault the viewer, and invite one to look while signaling the difficulty of looking. Why, after the rise and reign of photography, do so many people yet understand pen and paper to be among the best instruments of witness to war? There are many examples of the hybrid form of comics, drawn by hand, operating as documentary and addressing history, witness, and testimony. Today, figures such as Art Spiegelman, whose 2-volume Mouse, A Survivor's Tale, cemented comics as a serious medium for engaging history, Hiroshima survivor Keiji Nakazawa, and a growing number of others all over the globe, including Joe Sacco, a self-described comics journalist, seize public and critical attention with hand-drawn accounts and histories from Auschwitz, Bosnia, Palestine, and Ground Zero. In exploring how the form of comics operates as documentary, I focus on how war, at every turn, generates new forms of visual verbal witness. This past century's debates about documentary have been almost entirely about theorizing the filmic and the televisual, or the photographic. Documentary, like witness, is a non-transparent concept, or group of concepts, with a whole history and set of debates attached to it. But what it has not recently landed on in critical discourse is drawing, which is to say the hand-drawn document. Tonight, I want to gesture telescopically, as time allows, to a longer genealogy than we're used to having for comics. And I want to situate us in a conversation on the international parameters of nonfiction comics, considering the social and psychic urgencies that generated formal innovation across national boundaries. So this talk is based on a chapter I'm working on that considers together the work of Nakazawa and Spiegelman, whose phrase, "Disaster is my muse," gives my book its title. I'm interested in the role and the difference of drawing, and comics drawing specifically, for documentation as a general practice and witnessing as a specific one. Contemporary comics asks us to reconsider several dominant commonplaces about images in general and documentary images in particular. So first, there's the widespread commonplace that our culture is oversaturated with an all-too-easy, uncomplicated visuality. Harold Bloom, for instance, cautioned students in a New York Times op-ed in 2009 that, and I'm quoting him here, "Undergraduate education should be a voyage away from visual oversaturation into deep, sustained reading." The visual in this schema stands for the sensual, the affective, for easily immediate communication, a sort of subpar literacy. Yet comics texts often push back against this view of the visual because their combination of words and images requires an active and complicated literacy, one to which we can attach a slowed-down engagement of reading and looking for meaning. It seems to me that comics, Art Spiegelman has said, have already shifted from being an icon of illiteracy to becoming one of the last bastions of literacy. If comics have any problem now, it's that people don't even have the patience to decode comics at this point, he goes on. I don't know if we're the vanguard of another culture or if we're the last blacksmiths. This is in part due to how comics can retrack narrative, confuse the eye, or offer multiple directions of reading, say horizontal and vertical, as we see in just one randomly selected page from Spiegelman's In the Shadow of No Towers. So we have the two directions there. Texts that incorporate word and image create a spatial and temporal depth on the page that lends itself to formal experimentation. Understanding that term in Marianne de Koven's fundamental sense of experimental as the obstruction of normal reading. This textual density pits much comics work against what Nicholas Mertzoff identifies as today's quick-cut, present-tense-only mode of watching. Especially in the context of war reporting, the slowness of comics is both a mode of ethical awareness and an implicit critique of hyperactive and superficial news coverage. Second, and this is one of my central claims about comics across my work, comics works push on conceptions of the unrepresentable and the invisible that have become commonplace in discourse about trauma. The force and value of graphic narrative's intervention on the whole inheres in how comics works document, display, and furnish, taking us past what my colleague W.J.T. Mitchell calls trauma theory's cult of the unrepresentable. Claude Lanzmann, the French director of one of the world's most famous post-Holocaust texts, 1985's 9.5-hour film documentary Shoah, might be said to articulate this view, including in his most recent documentary, The Last of the Unjust, which is a shorter film at 4 hours, which I saw this past weekend. In Shoah, as many of you know, chilling, roaming landscapes of serene depletion, so shots of now empty fields and rustling trees, stand in the place of the replete images that comics in many ways delivers. Lanzmann, among many others, represents a dominant mode of theorizing trauma when he formulates his ethical refusal of understanding as a blindness. The blindness for me was the vital condition of creation, he has said. Blindness has to be understood here as the purest mode of looking, the gaze. Against a valorization of absence and aporia, graphic narrative asserts the value of presence, however complex and contingent. Its form helps us to see ourselves seeing, as Judith Butler wants us to, or as Mick Tausig puts it in his fabulous recent book, with the title, I Swear I Saw This, Drawings in Fieldwork Notebooks, namely my own, to be aware of seeing seeing, which is to say, to understand drawing as a doubled, duplicative process that calls attention to the work of vision and memory. Third, and related, comics about war engage the difficulty of spectacle, like a work like Picasso's Guernica also does, instead of turning away from it. Scholars across many fields, but especially those attuned to witness and trauma, are frequently concerned with spectacle and spectacularization. When a work is praised, it is frequently praised in the context of its avoiding or sidestepping spectacle. As you will see briefly here, the works I treat face, engage, and even sometimes produce spectacle, neither attaching themselves pruriently to spectacle nor avoiding it. They articulate violence through an interplay of word and image, space and sign, and past and present that is expressive of the textured quality of experience. They risk representation, and they refigure representation in Peter Galison and Lorraine Dastin's sense of the contemporary movement from representation to presentation, the shift from what they call image as representation to image as process. Comics is about contingent display, materially and philosophically. For if it is a form about presence, it is also stippled with erasure. In the interruption provided by the ambiguous spaces of what is known as the gutter, which is comic spaces of pause in between and outside of frames. Now, will all media do the work of framing? Comics manifests material frames and the absences between them on the page. It thereby literalizes the work of framing and making and also what it excludes. Comics is a conspicuously artificial form, calling attention to images and to language as material objects and not just as representation, a key issue in the communication of trauma and violence. With drawn boxes sitting next to each other on the page, comics openly eschews any aesthetic of transparency. Comics is a form that rejects the verisimilitude of mechanical objectivity and presents in turn a succession of drawn boxes, revealing its own process of making. At the same time, it is also a form forcefully invested in detailed documentation of place, of duration, of perspective, of material specificity, of embodiment. William Stott, author of the classic book Documentary Expression and 30s America, notes that documentary can take shape in any medium, and he defines it as a genre of actuality. The art critic John Berger's comments are instructive here in understanding how comics functions as documentary. Of a Vermeer painting of Delft, he writes that it has a plenitude of actuality, although one ought not to suppose, and I'm quoting him here, that this has to do with accuracy. Delft at any moment never looked like this painting. It has to do with the density per square millimeter of Vermeer's looking, the density per millimeter of assembled moments. If we can consider documentary then, along these lines as a set of evidential practices and a genre of actuality, or the creative treatment of actuality, to use John Grierson's famous coinage from the 1930s, it is my assertion that comics is currently increasing its reach, range, and depth. This includes not only the temporal difference from the more common documentary mediums of photography, generally composed of still frames, and film, generally composed of moving frames, since comics, as Anna pointed out, is paradoxically still and animate at once. We also see this in how comics takes up the problem of reference as central, both in its autographic aspect and in its constant juxtaposition of word and image. Comics marks a resurfacing and creative expansion in our contemporary world of the power of the hand-drawn image. The war comics I treat by Spiegelman, Nakazawa, and Sacco, among others, are crucially autobiographical and world historical. They work, as Spiegelman puts it, to grapple with the intersection between personal history and world history, a structure inherent, I believe, to the act of witnessing itself. In asking why there are so many difficult and even extreme world historical conflicts portrayed in the form of comics, and how it came to be a site of documentary that is expanding even as I write, I am centrally occupied, as I mentioned, with the question of how war generates new forms of witnessing. Specifically, I identify 1972 as the crucial moment for the global emergence of comics as a form for bearing witness to war and historical devastation. In this year, some of the earliest works of nonfiction comics emerge from different sides of World War II. Spiegelman's pivotal first mouse comic about his immigrant family's survival of Poland's death camps, and Hiroshima survivor Keiji Nakazawa's work of so-called atomic bomb manga, the standalone comic book Ore wa Mita, or I Saw It, a title that explicitly evokes Goya's famous caption in his Disasters of War series. In thinking comparatively, what I hope to suggest is how in looking at substantive innovation occurring at the same time from different sides of World War II, we can begin to paint a picture of why the early 70s gave rise to what has become the most trenchant kind of work within the comics field, nonfiction and nonfiction specifically about war. In the case of Spiegelman and Nakazawa, the obliteration wreaked by World War II, which each of them approached from a different cultural starting point, led to a new phase in the creation of visual verbal forms of witness. And here, while annihilated parental bodies explicitly motivate both works, Nakazawa's is an eyewitness account, while Spiegelman is a secondary witness. But while the genre of nonfiction comics developed in its contemporary specificity out of World War II, there are visual verbal antecedents for this tradition with which this work sees itself in conversation. The trajectory of forms I trace in this book, all of which circulated in print, so that's what I'm interested in, includes both work that we understand in a fine art context and popular and commercial formats. So important figures include printmaker and draftsman Jacques Callot, whose Miseries of War, a series of 18 prints inspired by the 30 Years' War, was uncommissioned and appeared inscribed with verse below its etched images. Callot directly influenced Goya, who worked in a similar idiom in his Disasters of War series, 83 numbered etchings created between 1810 and 1820. Each etching has a caption such as simply, "This I saw," and "That is how it happened." Goya's goal to evoke and show with handmade images as reporting has been important to contemporary cartoonists as a model for visual witnessing. A textured subjectivity emerges in the space of the relationship of caption to image, even as the images, many of which are of actual historical record, flag themselves as doing the work of reporting. The captions appearing below the images are not simply descriptive. Some are actually sarcastic, and some work against the fact of presentation of the image itself, such as in number 26, whose caption simply states, "One cannot look at this at the same time as it is presenting itself." The path that takes us from Callot and Goya to the present proceeds by way of the rise of the artist reporter, which began in the Illustrated News in London in the 1840s, and later the avant-garde idioms that established the role of the artist in the context of a new kind of visual journalism, allowing figures like George Grosz and Otto Dix, both significant influences on cartoonists, to report on war in Europe in the 1920s. In the U.S., with some exceptions, as photojournalism picked up in the 1940s, drawing was supplanted by photography and film in the realm of the documentary. Yet, fascinatingly, during World War II, fictional comics in the form of comic books, which were then a fairly recent format innovation, arose in the context of war. So even comic books dominated by genre conventions strove to incorporate history, and often quite violent history, into their plot lines. In a famous example, the cover of the March 1941 issue of Captain America shows the titular hero punching Hitler in the jaw after raiding Nazi headquarters. And this image, for those of you who have read this book, is the inspiration for Michael Chabon's novel, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. This kind of super heroic take on World War II history lasted for decades, as we also see in stories like the 1968 Sergeant Fury title, Triumph at Treblinka, whose cover pictures very well-fed looking prisoners lined up on the inside of a concentration camp barbed wire fence. There's also a whole spate of comics grappling with mushroom cloud imagery, like the Action Comics issue from 1946 that shows Superman hovering in the air, filming an atom bomb test, which is pictured here exploding with a huge red and white mushroom cloud spanning the cover's height. And less explicitly, but perhaps no less forcefully, as Spiegelman has suggested, we might consider the EC horror comics that bloomed in the 1950s as a secular American Jewish response to Auschwitz, as in the gory 1953 Vault of Horror issue, whose cover depicts passengers on a subway staring at a disembodied arm and hand gripping a hanging strap. It is striking that there were so many comics about the war that sought to engage deadly serious subject matter. And for me, it is particularly striking that many of these images, like Superman filming an atomic bomb and subway passengers gaping at a detached hand, are actually themselves about the act of witnessing. The desire to grapple with the war through images was powerful and inchoate, and many works engaged iconography obsessively, but history indirectly. It was not until 1972 that comics itself became a form for witnessing in any kind of nonfiction context. Motivated by World War II in the early 70s, Spiegelman and Nakazawa invented comics afresh as a testamentary form to violence. The world was gripped by the Vietnam War and saturated with its constant stream of televisual images, as its moniker, as the so-called living room war, indicates. Vietnam was part of the Cold War, and so in that sense was a continuation of World War II. We can further understand the return to drawing to tell, this reemergence and creative expansion in our contemporary world of the power of the hand-drawn image against the backdrop of this saturation and the discourses of technological power that shaped the atomic age. So on August 6, 1945, Keiji Nakazawa's father, older sister, and baby brother perished when the atomic bomb was dropped in Hiroshima City. The Nakazawa house collapsed on them and then went up in flames as his mother, who was pregnant, watched helplessly. He was 6 years old. He and his mother survived the blast, but his mother died ultimately from the leukemia so common to Hibakusha, survivors of the atomic war, in 1966. Nakazawa created the first atomic bomb manga as a cartoonist living in Tokyo after his mother's death. And for those few of you who may not know, manga refers as a general matter now to comics from Japan. It translates roughly as whimsical pictures. Nakazawa's early attempts, all fictional, to create narratives about Hiroshima in the late 60s were considered so politically radical that he had to publish them in an adult, meaning erotic, magazine. As Herbert Bix writes in the book Hiroshima in History and Memory, there was an immediate post-war censorship on publications about suffering that was imposed by the U.S. administration but was endorsed by both sides. And in this regard, the field of production with which Nakazawa was imbricated looks a lot like the American comics underground, where there was a kind of determined political radicalism that mixed with what was often the licentiousness of the taboo-shredding 1960s underground cartoonists. So finally, in 1972, the supportive editor of Monthly Shonen Jump, which Nakazawa himself describes as a lowbrow manga magazine, decided to publish a series of autobiographical comics by manga artists, and knowing of his personal connection to the bombing of Hiroshima, asked Nakazawa to be the first in the series. I saw it, Nakazawa's eyewitness account of August 6, 1945, whose title, as I mentioned, is evocative of Goya's famous caption, was published in October of 1972 as a standalone 45-page issue. And here's the cover of the English-language version, which was translated in 1982. And this work first appeared in black and white, but it was printed in the U.S. as a full-color comic book. And at that time in the 70s, there were not that many full-color comic books that were not superhero comics. So I saw it stood out, even in its U.S. context, as reclaiming comics conventions for a new subject. I saw it established a serious documentary mode for comics in Japan, and it was an unexpected success in the climate of the early 1970s, a time when embarrassment and shame and silence were still connected to the atomic bomb. Monthly Shonen Jump, where Nakazawa continued to publish related work about the bomb, went on to sell a million copies and then 2 million. In I Saw It, Nakazawa explicitly names himself as the author and protagonist of his narrative. So on page 2, as you can see here, the narration shifts from a sort of interiorized contemplative mode as the protagonist remembers his mother to a scene of public address and testimony down here, where his body and his visage turn outwards to face readers, and his speech balloon reads, "I am Keiji Nakazawa, born in Hiroshima City, March 1939, third son out of 5 kids. Like Art Spiegelman in Mouse, published the same year, he introduces himself immediately as a son of war-ravished parents. The next panel moves away from an exteriorized view of his body to a scene of his visual and oral memory framed by the words, "the earliest days I can remember." The 9 irregular panels on the page suggest the present-day character's distracted, fragmented psyche. Further, the page is marked by its disarticulated body parts. Keiji Nakazawa's feet, and the speech balloon here looks like it's coming up from his shoes, opens the panel, and it points against the direction of reading. His mother's running feet, down here, angled at the same direction, close the panel. So our first introduction to his mother is as disembodied movement. And there's also a sort of visual rhyme between his feet in this panel and her feet, which close the page. I Saw It is famous for visualizing the effect of the physical disfigurement wreaked by the bomb, such as bodies with flaps of dissolving skin dripping off of their frames. So here's a later page from I Saw It that is characteristic of Nakazawa's portrayal of the intense suffering caused by the bomb. So his child character, Stricken, declares, "everybody's turned into monsters." The kinds of images Nakazawa drew were new to Japanese culture. The framework of first-person testimony and visual witness was also, in this context, unprecedented. The grotesque clarity and directness of the comic book's images, which Nakazawa, who witnessed the fallout of Hiroshima with his own eyes, reconstructs for us here in a popular format, are an undeniable part of what makes I Saw It so powerful. The disjuncture between the exaggerated rendering in the story, which is conventional to manga, and the real decimating violence of the bomb throws into even greater proportion the catastrophe of the real in this narrative. In Nakazawa's recreation of his own Hiroshima experience as a graphic narrative created in Japan's most widely popular style, he structures his text around the productive tension between form, so here the overstated idiom of manga, and content, the indubitably traumatic and gravely serious subject of the devastation of the U.S. bombing of Hiroshima. These graphic details show that Nakazawa's intervention resides as much in his visual idiom as in his political content. Nakazawa responded to the most high-tech of high technology, the atomic bomb, and the ominous march of technological scientific progress it represented with the deliberately low-tech primary practice of hand drawing. He counters the idea of the bomb itself as documentarian, so the bomb as camera imprinting shadows on cement, And here are some examples. With his own form of witnessing and documentation, marking by hand. The same year in San Francisco, Art Spiegelman, born in Sweden in 1948 to Polish Holocaust survivors, produced Mouse, a three-page story that is the prototype for his longer two-volume work of the same name. It appeared in Funny Aminals, and I'm not misspeaking, an underground comic book anthology, and it employed the abstraction of an animal metaphor while yet announcing itself as a nonfiction narrative. And here, as Mariana Hirsch has pointed out, Spiegelman filters his father's experience through the famous Margaret Bourke White photograph of the liberation of prisoners at Buchenwald. Spiegelman interviewed and taped his father, Vladek, who's unnamed in the piece, about surviving Auschwitz. The transmission of that testimony from father to son is the framework of the story. Mouse, unlike I Saw It, was received with very little fanfare in 1972. So Spiegelman recounts that cartoonists, unable to assimilate the serious content, didn't know how to react, so they complimented his rendering of mice. Meanwhile, his father's survivor friends, completely unable to see the mice or to recognize visually shaped narrative, reacted only by situating themselves in relation to the facts presented in the story, like I came out of this camp in this month type of thing. In the Robert Crumb cover to Funny Aminals, which I showed you before, we can recognize, as with I Saw Its appearance in the lowbrow boys magazine monthly Shonen Jump, what might seem like a discordance. Serious work about the status of eyewitnessing in an uncharted form, yet shaping and being shaped by the field of the popular. Spiegelman and Nakazawa's foundational texts opened a new phase for hand-drawn forms of witness. They were a phenomenon in popular culture, Spiegelman's Mouse eventually, and in the representation of war more broadly. I Saw It became the basis for Nakazawa's globally important book series, Barefoot Gen, a cartoon story of Hiroshima, a project he started in 1972 as a long serial. Mouse became the basis for the long-form graphic narrative Mouse, a Survivor's Tale, arguably the world's most famous work of comics, which first appeared serially in 1980 in Raw magazine and was published to massive critical acclaim by Pantheon in two book volumes in 1986 and 1991. Forever altering the terrain of American comics. Barefoot Gen was the first book-length manga translated into English in 1978 by an international group of peace activists. And Spiegelman read it that year. Japan's comics culture grew enormously after World War II, when Western comics were imported in large number, and strong narrative structures for comics developed in children's comics publications, which then claimed adult audiences, shifting the field dramatically. However, Japan's comics culture developed from culturally specific antecedents that shape its tradition, such as early 12th century picture scrolls, which were often religious, and secular woodblock prints from the 17th century and beyond, which were intended for a popular audience. The Japanese manga tradition and the US-European comics tradition have developed, by and large, independently, but we can see that globally, these spaces of the popular were expanded and really reinvented in the early 1970s to address the disturbing legacies of war. Now, this became especially clear to me while working with the Mouse Archives for the MetaMouse project. This archive revealed traditions of visual witness related to World War II that I argue led almost directly to the underground comics culture that sprouted in the late 1960s and early 1970s, and which is responsible for the existence of any kind of adult comics field that we have in the U.S. today. So Spiegelman grew up with parents who, in keeping what was for some a tacit mandate of post-war American Jewish immigrant culture, didn't address with him in any explicit way what their experiences in Poland had been. So as a child, he knew there was something called the war, but his encounters of learning about it were a series of jarringly disconnected moments, mostly oral, liken this scene from his memoir, Portrait of the Artist as a Young Blankety Blank. And I'll just let you read this on your own, but it's a sort of horrifying conversation that his parents are having with him in the car about Sonderkommandos. However, during the widely televised Eichmann trial in 1961, when he was 13, Spiegelman went searching through his parents' private bookshelf, the forbidden bookshelf. The most significant object that he found, however, unlike in many similar accounts, was not photographic. Spiegelman discovered mostly Polish and Yiddish small press pamphlets published right after the war, many of them picturing everyday life in the camps. Although he couldn't read the text because he didn't know the languages, the images, the amateur graphic design and the humble printing, constituted his first understanding of life during the war, which is to say his parents' circumstance. His first full experience of recognition with what the Holocaust had been was visual and drawn, handmade images of witness. Now, some of these were what we would think of as quite cartoony. So one was a booklet basically of gag cartoons by a Ukrainian inmate about Auschwitz with jokes like, ha-ha, you didn't get any soup. You know, pretty funny. One pamphlet that had little watercolor drawings of Ravensbrück printed out of register struck Spiegelman deeply. And here are a few images from these pamphlets. This is from one called Auschwitz. These are both from 1946. Here's the one called Ravensbrück and an image from that. Spiegelman's encounter with these unpretentious, cartoon-like drawings of what he calls the oxymoron of life in a death camp was formative for his later field-defining Maus. Maus first appeared chapter by chapter in similarly designed and printed serial booklets in the 1980s. So here's a page from MetaMaus juxtaposing down here the pamphlets and here the chapters of Maus as they first appeared in Raw. And so the chapters of Maus were a deliberate homage to the pamphlets from the 40s. So that his experience was visual and necessarily not verbal at the level of comprehension also allowed Spiegelman to encounter the discourse of the visual in a heightened way, even as it shared space on the page with captions. So Spiegelman says in MetaMaus about surviving art from the war, those drawings were a return to drawing not for its possibilities of imposing the self, of finding a new role for art and drawing after the camera, but rather a return to the earlier function that drawing served before the camera, a kind of commemorating, witnessing, and recording of information, what Goya referred to when he says, "This I saw." I want to suggest that it is exactly these traditions of drawn witnessing seen in the post-war pamphlets and other survivor and non-survivor art that opened up the creation of today's comics field. Unearthing these archives and histories, we can trace the cross-continental movement of the booklets from Europe to the US, where they helped instigate aesthetically and documentarily ambitious forms of graphic narrative in the taboo-shattering underground period. Other meaningful examples of this tradition of hand-drawn images of witnessing include Horst Rosenthal's cartoon pamphlet titled Mickey in Gurs, which he made in the camps in 1942, and he died in Auschwitz that same year, and a range of work by camp inmates, just a few examples of which I'll show here. And here is a page from Spiegelman's Maus. We can, in fact, understand the contemporary comics field, so deeply shaped and conditioned by the success of Maus, as inspired by and even founded on these earlier acts of witness to war and disaster. I Saw It and Maus are both narratives of terror that devolve on images of terror. The zombie-like, decomposing citizens of Hiroshima that Nakazawa witnessed firsthand, and the corpses, both actual and implied, that people the son's visual reconstruction of his father's death camp testimony. We might think of approaching World War II after the broad silence that surrounded the war in America and in Japan as mandating afresh what Viktor Shklovsky, writing in 1925, named the fundamental device of art, permitting a new seeing of reality instead of mere recognizing or acknowledging. Comics, I propose, picks up steam as a form of this new seeing. Motivated by the urgencies of re-seeing or revisioning the war, comics sought to defamiliarize received images of history and also to communicate, to circulate in realms of the popular. In the early 1970s, the emotional and intellectual exigencies of World War II had had the opportunity to metabolize into formal innovation, into expanding modalities for capturing traumatic histories that weren't yet a part of a culture of expression. In comics documenting war, we also understand the form's ability specifically to reconstitute lost bodies in its drawn lines. The subject, and often the procedure of composing comics, is a kind of compensation for lost bodies, for lost histories, a resurrection or materialization of bodies in form in the mark on the page. While both Anja Spiegelman and Kimi Nakazawa survived the war, in a sense, killed both mothers in the late 1960s. Spiegelman was a suicide in 1968. Nakazawa died, as mentioned, from radiation-induced leukemia in 1966. Like Mouse, dedicated to Anja Spiegelman, I saw it as an obituary for an absent mother destroyed by World War II. Documenting experience in hand-drawn comics boxes presents a psychic and material architecture of history and memory. The reconstruction of bodies on the page, what Spiegelman has called materializing history, addresses this loss with visual shape. There is a kind of instantiation of the lost body on the page in comics. The artist William Kentridge has said, "It isn't a matter of making drawing of things in preparation for something else, but of making drawing literally into other things." Drawing is not just mimetic. It is its own artifact, substance, thing, phenomenology. Comics' ability to visually articulate and map these stories of witness has made it crucial for first-person expression and, perhaps anachronistically, for forms of reporting and documenting war. This hand-drawn form has reemerged after the age of the camera, reinventing visual culture and culture at large through urgent acts of witness. Thank you. Hi.
Hi. That was a wonderful talk. Thank you. I was wondering about the role of seriality. So graphic novels that are serialized, which, of course, protracts the slow reading, right, over weeks or years. And the ones that are, you know, in the packaging, repackaging of the serialized ones, or the texts that are documenting war that are just published, you know, as a complete work. Also, because serialization or the repetition is so crucial to the processing of trauma. So I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about the role of that and how you see that impacting the power of the documentation or the witnessing of the war, the trauma of war.
Yeah, so that's a great question. Thank you for that question. So almost all of the work I'm interested in initially was serialized, including Kello and including Goya, right? So these were separate and discrete numbered etchings, right? So I'm very interested in the serial and the episodic and how that has some kind of meaningful relationship to expressing and apprehending trauma. So there's sort of two ways to answer your question, and one is more cultural. And that is to say, I'm fascinated by the fact that there could be a comic book that comes out serially called Palestine, right? It has the price on it. That costs $2.95 that you can buy at the comic book store. There's something that seems so, on one hand, discordant about this, and on the other hand, makes a lot of sense. Why shouldn't there be this, right? And Sacco is playing into a lot of what we would expect from a popular serial format. I mean, look at the big shadowed, colorful letters, right? Here's his little By Joe Sacco down here in the mud underneath the headstone. So I'm interested in how comics has always been a form that's been interested in its own accessibility and its own circulation, right? So if you're thinking about images of war, you know, attic vases depicted scenes from the Iliad, right? So you can go back as far back as you want there, but I'm really interested in circulation and in print, and the serial has always been part of that, and it has to do with accessibility. And then on another level, I think in terms of trauma and expressing trauma, what fascinates me about comics is how it inscribes what I think of as a kind of logic of seriality onto every page, right? Because it not only comes out in a serial format like a comic book, but it's composed of a series of juxtaposed boxes, right? So it's always making readers do this kind of work of reading serially, even in one example of one page, right? There's always a kind of serial recursive logic to how one reads comics. So it encodes this kind of interest in the fragment and interest in aggregating frames of evidence in its very reading. So that's a great question. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Hilary Choot, professor of English at the University of Chicago. Professor Choot's lecture was titled Comics as Documentary, Words, Images, and War, and was presented by the Boston University Arts and Sciences Center for the Humanities. Tonight's moderator was Anna Henchman, assistant professor of English at Boston University. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Marquise Neal. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.